Hello and welcome to the Indian Ocean World podcast. My name is Philip Gooding and I'm a project manager at the Indian Ocean World Centre at McGill University. For this podcast, I am thrilled to be joined by Professor Tasha Reich Epstein of Vanderbilt University, where she's an assistant professor of history and a Robert Penn Warren Centre faculty fellow. Professor Reich Epstein's research focuses on material transformations of everyday life in Madagascar and the southwestern Indian Ocean. Her work explores how people have reworked the material world over time, informed by their hopes and aspirations, political ideologies, and technical know-how. She has published in several leading journals, including the Journal of African History, History and Technology, and Africa. In this podcast, we'll be discussing her monograph, which is entitled Children of the Soil, The Power of Built Form in Madagascar, and was published with Duke University Press last year to high acclaim. Children of the Soil is a spatial and material history of the Indian Ocean port city of Majanga on the northwestern coast of Madagascar. Professor Reich Epstein, thank you very much for joining us for this podcast. The first question I want to ask you, though, is about this port city. Why Majanga? Can you give a short introduction of where and what this place is to our audience who may not be familiar with the geography of northwestern Madagascar? And also, what drew you to it? And what made you focus your research and your book on this port city?
Thank you so much, Philip. I am so excited to be here. I just want to begin by thanking you for the invitation to talk about the book and to be in conversation with you, especially given some of our shared interests in the environment and in kind of long durée histories. So it's really a pleasure to be here. So why Majanga is... I had sort of a long, convoluted path to this city as the centerpiece of the book. And so I'll answer a little bit of the question of sort of what this city is through my description of how I kind of got to be there. So some of my interests that showed up in the book really emerged. They go back quite a ways to my time as an undergraduate and then as a master's student. So I have a very kind of complicated family history connections to different parts of the African continent that led to really long-standing interest for me in colonialism. And so as an undergraduate, I studied in Zimbabwe. Then I kind of pursued these questions later as a master's student in South Africa in a very multidisciplinary program that was looking at the post-apartheid transition. And this program really sensitized me and others in the program to the kind of politics of knowledge production and especially the production of history. And I did an early research project there in South Africa on kind of contested histories around a case of land restitution in the Eastern Cape. And this case involved several thousand claimants, and their claims to the land hinged on these narratives of migration to the region in the 19th century. But they were, of course, kind of countered by white South African farmers who questioned the chronology of these migration narratives. And even within the claimant group, there were a lot of different conceptions as well about the group's political genealogies. So my introduction to the kind of politics of place and these issues around contested productions of history was really through the eyes of the claimants in this land restitution case in an area called Makoba. And I realized I needed more training in anthropology and history to kind of understand those issues. So that then brought me to pursue the PhD program that I did in anthropology and history at the University of Michigan. So initially, I thought of returning to that region of South Africa. And then through a series of kind of serendipitous events, I found myself drawn to Madagascar through a number of different courses I took with faculty. And especially with my advisor, one of my two advisors, Gillian Philly Harnick, who was an anthropologist of Madagascar, and she really introduced me to this place as this terrific crossroads of people from all over the Indian Ocean world, from its earliest peopling, you know, around, I mean, this is debated, when did the island first become settled, but around kind of the middle of the first millennium of the Common Era. And then within Madagascar, Majanga is especially fascinating because it's part of the island that has had really old ties to all different parts of the Indian Ocean basin. So Majanga is located on the northwest coast, quite close to the Comorian archipelago, quite far from the capital city of Antananarivo. And it's a place where people have migrated from all across the island as well as from across the Indian Ocean basin. So South Asia, the Hadramaut, parts of East Africa, and especially the Comoros. Now, at the same time that I was getting interested in Madagascar in graduate school, I was also in the midst of these really rich conversations that were happening at the University of Michigan around kind of history of science and technology, which got me thinking in all kinds of ways about the material world and about infrastructures and built forms as these kinds of sites of contestation and memory and meaning making. So one more piece that might be helpful to mention is as I was beginning to do some preliminary research and really thinking of developing a project around histories of migration and mobility around the city, I visited the city with my family in 2009. And one of the striking features in the city that I noticed were these intricately carved wooden doors in the old section of the city. Now it's called Majunga Bay. The French called it Ancien Majunga. And these doors bore striking resemblance to the famed iconic doors of Zanzibar. And I was immediately intrigued, right? Like, what kinds of Indian Ocean affinities and knowledges were at play that allowed these kind of the continuity of these doors between these port towns across the Mozambique Channel? You know, and these, as scholars have shown, these Indian Ocean doors also have, you know, ties to Gujarat and other parts of South Asia. So that kind of opened, I could say more about the doors, but I think what's important is that, you know, Madagascar is not often thought of in tandem with the Swahili coast or parts of Eastern Africa. And so that physical architectural feature signaled to me that there was sort of more to unpack there about those ties that were not just ancient Indian Ocean ties, but also more recent ones. And they really kind of pulled those doors, really pulled me into the history of the city. I should add, though, that the doors, I didn't actually end up focusing that much on the doors themselves in the book, but it did open up a host of questions for me about kind of migration, questions of origins, knowledge, and power that I tried to kind of trace out throughout the chapters.
It's interesting that you mentioned the doors here, even though you're right that they're not maybe the central focus of the book. Because reading parts of the book, I kept on thinking about the Swahili coast as well. In fact, in the introductory chapter, there's a sentence in there that really spoke to me in terms of my understandings of the history of urbanism in the Western Indian Ocean world. And I'm going to quote it back to you, so apologies for that. But it says, rather than following a simple teleology of soft to hard, ephemeral to obdurate, or thatch to stone, the becoming of Majunga witnessed the tangled coexistence of multiple materials with overlapping temporalities and distinctive meanings. And to me, I felt like this had so much applicability to recent histories of the Swahili coast, which have begun to turn away from the old focus on stone architecture and have emphasized, for example, the long-term importance of wattle and daub as well. And I kind of wondered kind of what your wider thoughts are here. How far do you think these ideas of multiple materialities and overlapping temporalities could be a model for thinking through urbanisms in zones outside of northwestern Madagascar, including elsewhere in the Indian Ocean world? Are you thinking, how were you trying to situate Majunga in the wider region as you research and wrote the book?
Yeah, thank you for that question. So I will be candid and say that this framing came up fairly late in the writing process of the book. So initially, I approached the city with an idea that, or an assumption that the city probably had hardened over time, that there were these earlier vegetative structures that then gradually became hardened over time. But as I started looking more closely at my sources, I saw that was not necessarily true, that there was a real persistence of ephemeral construction. And that actually the preservation or persistence of these ephemeral building practices was really important, really constitutive of political and social collectivities. So for example, I think I speak about this in maybe one of the first chapters of the book, the shrine, the Sakalava shrine that is still today in Majunga's area. Now it's just outside the city, but I speak about it also when it was in an earlier place in the heart of the city, that there are a whole set of ritual prohibitions against building part of that shrine in durable materials. And the idea is that, you know, by having fence posts and things that are made of vegetative materials, they are going to need to be rebuilt over time, every, say, several years. And in so doing, that brings together, that moment of rebuilding is a way of bringing back together a kind of political collectivity of royal followers and reconstituting that social collectivity and in the act of rebuilding. So there's a way in which ephemerality is actually very, very important to the reproduction of power and social collectivities. So so that then led me to think, you know, not just about kind of durable and ephemeral structures, but also unbuilding. What was never built? Why was it not built? Right. And so I think that attending to these multiple materialities, as well as the different kind of temporalities that they are linked with, is really fruitful for getting at different kinds of political projects that they make possible, the kind of memories that they can hold. So just to say a little bit more about this, and then I'll link it back to how we might think about urbanism more broadly. So French colonizers were actually very, very ambivalent and sometimes quite hostile to ephemeral construction. So at times they were really prohibiting durable architecture. They did not want migrant laborers to come and build durable structures. This was a way of trying to prevent people from settling into the city. This was especially true in the early decades of the 1900s. And then this perspective, of course, though, was shaped by a certain logic and a kind of regime of value that really elevated permanence and fixity over ephemerality. So now, you know, there's been art historians, there's a wonderful book that just came out by an architectural historian, Anu Siddiqui, that's looking at exactly this issue of the kind of politics of ephemerality. But what this shows is that how managing building materials is really about managing time. It's about producing particular landscapes with particular life cycles. And by prohibiting durable construction, the French colonial authorities were also trying to kind of constrain the political capital that migrants might accrue over time. And of course, some migrants contested this. They embraced these hardened forms. And they managed to maintain their families and kind of perpetuate their families through a number of political and economic upheavals, but by drawing on these kind of sedimented, lasting built forms. And that was particularly true for one of the key groups in the book, which are Comorian and Malagasy mixed families. So I will also just say that in speaking with people, and this will probably come up also a little later in our conversation, but in speaking with people about their homes, they narrated their homes as kind of archives. They narrated their family genealogies through the incremental hardening of their homes. And so it was not uncommon for somebody to narrate, you know, my grandmother inherited this land and she built the house of thatch. And then my mother came and was able to rebuild the house in corrugated tin or steel. And then, you know, now we've been able to rebuild it in a stone material. So in that way, houses became a kind of archive of these generational contributions and legacies and lineages. So to zoom out in terms of the implications more broadly, I think methodologically, it's really fruitful to follow materials over time and space, right? To kind of trace out their genealogies, to get an idea of how power is expressed over time and brought about. And scholars have kind of followed this methodology in other contexts too, looking at different materials in parts of Asia and things like this, which have shown, you know, how particular materials can be linked to also sort of patronage networks and luxury objects, things like that. And I guess there's just a few other things I want to say about this. One is that I think that attending to materiality also opens up some possibilities for sensory history, for the experiential, for ways of knowing, right? So not just how are places and spaces experienced, but what kinds of skills and tacit knowledge are required to actually transform these materials into built forms? Who does that work? And I think this can provide a really useful and important complement to more kind of conceptual discursive histories that are in a more kind of abstract domain. And doing this kind of work in cities is really fruitful because those are dense sites of encounter and contact where people are constantly negotiating their positioning in these really dynamic spaces and materials can kind of take on new meanings. And then finally, to get at the question around temporalities, I think that materials are so useful for rethinking these inherited chronologies that we have, right? So some scholars have written about sort of ages of materials, right? We live in an age of concrete or we have regimes of different material construction. And we now have a really rich body of scholarship from the Swahili coast and beyond that's really looking at the kind of multiple materialities and temporalities of construction. But I think as more and more cities across the world grapple with impacts of climate change, looking at the multiple temporalities of cities is also helpful for understanding sort of slow violence, right? The way that ecological crises are slowly unfolding. And also alongside the spectacular violence of kind of catastrophic events, whether it be flooding or whatnot. So yeah, I think that there is a lot that can be carried forward in other urban contexts for understanding a little more of this relationship between materiality, temporality, and power, especially amidst changing ecological conditions.
It's wonderful. Thank you very much for that answer. And it speaks to so many of your book's core contributions, which is to draw this, the history of the built environment and how it changed over time in multiple different contexts and from multiple different people over the long term. It's a wonderful kind of, not just a great contribution to understanding the history of this port city, but also to kind of a methodological contribution. I found it really inspiring. I want to kind of ask you some more about the methodology as well, about how you came to it and how you constructed it. You place significant importance on the more than human. You refer to it as the more than human in the book. You've alluded to some of it there, kind of in terms of senses. You refer to shrines and ancestors. You refer to ecologies and climate change. I want to kind of give an example from the book as well here. In chapter two, you linked the gradual decay of the Marina Rover. So the Marina, for listeners who are not familiar, Marina was an empire centered in the highlands of Madagascar towards the east of the island. And in the early 19th century, they established a governor's palace and fort, which over time decayed due to material limitations of specific building materials in northwestern Madagascar's environmental conditions. But instead of thinking about these just in terms of the physicality and the environment, your analysis really cleverly and interesting spoke to the histories and actions of ancestors and spirits. And I wondered, basically, what drew you to make these links between the environment and the spiritual world, not just in people's cosmologies, but as entangled actants in the historical process? And you can ask similar questions about similar phenomena in other chapters, which you link the built environment to emotions. What inspired you to make these methodological turns, and how did you accomplish them as well?
Yeah, so to answer that, I think I need to just explain a little bit of context. So the city, you know, the city really began kind of mid-18th century as a trading post. And at that time, the Sakalava political capital or ritual capital was in Maravoi and even in another town before that, some 60 kilometers far away. Even though there was this kind of separation between the trading capital and the ritual capital, the city of Majunga was widely recognized as Tani Sakalav. And what I mean by Tani Sakalav, Tani is the word for land or earth. And what I mean by that phrase is that it was governed by Sakalav ancestral norms. And we know this because written European accounts talk about Sakalava prohibitions on building and durable stone materials. Those were to be reserved only for certain tombs and royal structures. This is true in other parts of the island as well. By the 1780s, these were overturned by a particular monarch, Ravahini. And then what we see is traders, Antalotra, Indian, and other traders begin building these stone houses. And Majunga begins to get more greatly resembled Swahili coastal towns. So historiographically speaking, that made sense to me. So that the city sort of fell in line with these studies looking at, you know, early architecture and city building along the Swahili coast and these Indian Ocean towns, like those case studies that we have, Majunga. You know, I could see that this role of local agency in building and designing tombs and mosques and stone houses. It was also evident in the sources, the way that those houses and compounds had kind of structured different activities and social values and so on. What was surprising to me is just what you're picking up on, this moment of kind of glimpses into the more than human flickers in the land, in the archive, and the way that building projects and kind of contested moments of governance were taking place in this landscape inhabited by the living, but also by ancestral presences, by spirits, by related prohibitions around land and building. And so this really came out of my sources. So to go back to this example that you offered, and maybe just say in a little more detail, you know, in so following the conquest of the Northwest region by the Merina monarchy in about 1825, 1826, the Merina soldiers enter the city. They decide that they are going to build a shrine and actually bring the Sokolov relics that are really the heart of royal power. To possess those means that you really can possess the power and authority and legitimate authority over a space. So they wanted to build this new shrine in the city on top of a hill, and they were going to bring these royal relics to this shrine. And I was astounded to read in this, and this insight came from, I should just situate, came from a 19th century letter that was written from an administrator in Majunga in Malagasy. He's writing back to the monarch in Antananarivo, and he's explaining that, you know, we're trying to build this shrine, and we had this plan that the relics were being carried to the shrine. However, we ran into a problem and the ancestors didn't agree. And the porter who was burying them, who's carrying them, became rigid and frozen and could no longer move. He couldn't go anywhere. His feet wouldn't travel. So this administrator is writing back in a kind of, you know, moment of both. To me, my reading of the letter was both, he's writing out in tremendous fear about what the implications of this really are, and also frustration because he's trying to legitimate power in this newly conquered region. And eventually this porter is able to bring the relics and they are able to construct this. But it was so fascinating because it just revealed how people really understood and experienced these ancestral presences as very obstructionist at times of building projects, at other times enabling. And I will also say, you know, it's worth noting that the reference to this porter as frozen or frigid or, you know, kind of fixed in time, in the context of 19th century Madagascar, people would have understood that as akin to a kind of deathly state, right? That's a kind of cold, frozen sort of state of being. And so that was only going to bode poorly for this newly expanding Merina monarchy. So that's one piece of it. I think the more than human landscape, though, also shaped the contours. This is another important intervention I try to make in the book, is that it really shaped the contours of who could claim different forms of belonging to a particular place. So later, as more and more migrants are coming from the Comoros, so now I'm speaking of sort of early 20th century, these were mostly men coming from Comoros who intermarry with Malagasy. And these families and these migrants were said to respect, that they were very respectful of these ancestral prohibitions on the land. And that understanding those prohibitions enabled them to integrate into the city in a way that other migrant groups didn't. And I think this is important to emphasize because they were settlers in a sense, and yet they did not claim their ties to the city of Majunga by discounting or erasing the presence of those that already lived there, whether the living or the dead that came before them. They respected those beings, and they did not anchor their claims to that place primarily in, you know, occupancy or in property holding, but in their ability to transform spaces in accordance with and respecting these prohibitions and ritual practices associated with the land. So in that way, the more than human landscape becomes also important for understanding, you know, the limits and possibilities for groups to integrate into a city, newcomer groups. And in that way, the book tries to offer what I call a sort of parable on the ethics of being a good settler from an African context, which I think we don't actually, I think that a lot of African historiography, there's much to contribute to larger global debates around indigeneity and settler nations and so on. And so that, I think there's more to be mined there in other case studies, but seeing how these migrants were able to engage with the city as a more than human world was really important for understanding the ways that they also kind of wove narratives about their ability to belong to that place.
Thanks very much. One of the really great things about your book, at least to my mind, is the attention that you pay to the visual archive. That your book is filled with figures. There are images of portraits, maps, postcards, even chocolate wrappers, which both illustrate and demonstrate some of your core arguments. And reading the captions, I know that some of them came from archives and some came from your own personal collection. And I wondered, how did you create this archive? How important was it that it was included in your book? Because I think it's fairly unusual for academic books, particularly in the humanities, to have this many figures. And were there any images that you wanted to include but couldn't for whatever reason? But how did you create this archive, and what does it mean to include it in the book itself?
Yeah, thanks, Philip, for that question. So I was rather indiscriminatory in my curation of images. I just began to kind of gather any and all images that I could find, postcards especially, that I found in any venue that I could find that related to Majunga. I gathered and acquired, and they were relatively inexpensive things to purchase over time, but they began to, soon I sort of saw I was actually amassing a kind of mini archive of these postcards. And then I was really elated to discover these many of the photographic images here in the diplomatic archives in France, which are from a photographer by the name of Albert Pinard. He was a photographer in the city in the kind of late 19th century, and many of his photographs are in this book, including the cover image. I think, you know, these images felt really important to me to include because I was trying to bring to life this place that I knew most readers would be very unfamiliar with, even specialist readers. Or specialists in African history or Indian Ocean. Madagascar is still a place, as I mentioned before, that has not been kind of central in those conversations. And so I wanted to really bring to life this place. And because it is such a place and space specific book, it felt like there was a lot of opportunities to do that with the images that I had. Now, having said that, these images are not unproblematic. These are postcards that were largely taken, you know, for the purposes, I mean, the history around who took them is actually also very interesting, because there's another sort of history that I didn't get into around kind of Goan photographers who traveled throughout the Indian Ocean taking many of these postcard images. Some of those families, I suspect, were also those that took some of the postcard images in this book. But these postcard images were taken largely for the purposes of, you know, circulating back to the metropole, making Madagascar legible to publics in France and Europe. The same could be true for the chocolate wrappers. I think what became really revealing was the handwritten messages in the margins of some of these postcards. You know, you would have these kinds of notes of tenderness and affection for somebody back home that were written on a postcard portraying massive destruction and loss of people's homes following the 1902 plague, for example. And those homes were mostly owned by South Asian traders or Antolocho traders. So this kind of juxtaposition, right, of this sort of horrific destruction on one hand that then became paired with these sentiments on the other was, I think, something that was disturbing at times to grapple with. I will also say the only images that I wish I had been able to include more of or do more with are maps. So the maps in the book were extremely difficult to construct, actually. I was very humbled in the process of putting those maps together because I wanted to show dynamic processes and became quickly aware of how challenging that is to do on maps. And I'm continue to marvel at my colleagues who are more skilled in the way of working with maps. So that is something that, you know, I hope to kind of explore and do more with in the future. But I will say that in general, the kind of problematizing of the images themselves, this piece felt a little unfinished in the book. I wish that I had been able to do more with that. I was trying to use these images as kind of one among many fragments to piece together everyday life experiences in the city over a long expanse of time. But admittedly, more could be done to read those photographs.
Yeah, wonderful. I really enjoyed looking at them and studying them as I read the book. In fact, that added so much to the history describing. And yeah, as someone who's not a specialist in Northwest Madagascar history, it was just, it was fantastic. I think you achieved your aim there. And then I kind of want to ask you, also, maybe this should have been the first question. The idea of children of the soil, the title of your book, This is a translation of a Malagasy term, Zanatani or Zanatan, which became popularized, as you write in your book, in the early 20th century. And I just kind of want to know the kind of your reasons for using this term as your framing device, especially considering that this was a term that became popularized in the early 20th century. And you notice that it's not so popular now as well. And in addition to that, your book starts at the end of the 18th century. What was it about particularly Zanatan that made you, that is particularly useful for thinking through this long-term history?
So when I was approaching the project, I was conversant with this now voluminous literature we have from Indian Ocean histories, where the Indian Ocean is cast as this place of exchange and connectedness and cultural mixture. And one of the, I think, assumptions that emerged from the early scholarship was that of sort of cosmopolitanism, right? That these are necessarily, these Indian Ocean entrepôts are sort of necessarily places where there's all kinds of linguistic and cultural and religious mixture between African, European, Indian groups, Muslim, Christian, Arabic, Swahili speakers, English, you know, so on and so forth. And that coastal communities were necessarily open to absorbing outsiders. And then I was also thinking of the broader history we have from the continent that is documenting in great detail the kind of contestations between natives and newcomers, insiders, outsiders, the ways that those tensions get negotiated and resolved over time. So when I was approaching the city as both an archive and a kind of field, these were the frames I had in mind, right? The Indian Ocean is a place of connectivity, also these migration histories wrapped up with contestations over belonging. Then I encountered this term of Zanatan, as you pointed out, which literally means children of the soil. And I encountered this in people's everyday parlance, people's everyday talking was constantly referring to this term of Zanatan. And this was especially true in the Camoria Malagasy families that I began to collaborate with most closely. And what I soon realized is that this term was not fitting into these categories that I was familiar with of sort of cosmopolitanism or creolité or autochthony. And it was very striking to me that people, and especially again, these Camoria Malagasy families were situating Zanatan as a spatial practice. So they were directly linking their homes as evidence of their status as Zanatan, as children of the soil, as those that really belong to the city. In doing so, they were often contrasting themselves with newer migrants who they characterized as, you know, more concerned with sending money to construct tombs or sending money back to their families and their home villages elsewhere on the island than with building a house in the city, which was seen as a way of accumulating value and prestige. They also used this term Zanatan to emphasize a kind of urbanism that was a way of life based on, you know, sociality and Islamic practices of solidarity and proper kind of kinship relations. And so then when I just began tracing this term, I took this term from these ethnographic encounters and oral interviews that I did and kind of went back to the archive and was surprised to discover that French colonial authorities really codified this term, Zanatan, as a kind of racial ethnic category in census records, and they used it to denote not just a racial ethnic category, but also a generational category to denote the Métis children of these Camoria Malagasy couples. So this concept became really important in the book because by following this concept over time, I was able to see how these categories of belonging and difference were anchored, as I said, in this spatial transformation well before, even before the rise of Zanatan as a term, this sort of the negotiation of belonging by transforming space was evident. And I think, you know, while we have this really rich literature of, I would say, sort of intellectual history that's looking at the ways that people have made ethnic, racial, or other kinds of differential categories through arguments that they waged, you know, ideological debates, whether in the context of nationalism or more recently where people are working out kind of bounds of citizenship, it became evident that people are claiming belonging in this whole host of material ways, in addition to these verbal and written claims, and in ways that really challenge the categories of first comer and late comer, insider, outsider, as discrete categories. So I found that this term Zanatani helpfully complicated or contributed, I guess I should say, to a very, what felt like a limited vocabulary, limited scholarly vocabulary for understanding belonging. If we just think in these kind of dichotomies, right, we're missing all the gradations of belonging. And so I would argue, like, we need more, we need to dive more into language as an archival source for understanding these gradations of belonging and different ways of sort of nuanced forms of belonging and nuanced forms of agency that allowed some migrants to maneuver these kinds of social and political formations in really complicated ways. Now, I want to also signal, though, in your question was a point about the early period, like, is this an anachronism in some ways or something like that? You didn't ask it in that way, but perhaps one could. So there is a very strong correlation or strong connection, I should say, between the category, the sort of ethnonym of antolotra, which is translated as people of sea, and the people who constitute or self-identify as Zanatan in more contemporary times. And the overlap there is that both of these groups recall or invoke mixed ancestry, right? These are Muslim Comoria Malagasy groups. They often are also pulling on some ancestry related to East Africa, the Hadhramaut. Antolotra for Indian Ocean listeners are going to be very close to Swahili traders. So there's all those associations. So there was, I began to be convinced that there is a kind of transformation that begins to happen where people of the sea then actually begin to identify more as people of the soil. And we see this sort of shift. Very few people in the city today would identify themselves as Antolotra. Very, very few. There's some, but that does not mean, though, that Zanatan forwent ties to the literal, to the ocean, that many Zanatan still retain, even till today, you know, trading ties and ocean-going practices to the Comorian archipelago. But over time, these families did invest greater and greater energy in landed ties in Madagascar. And I think this was alongside shifts in the rise of global capitalism. So I could have named the book People of the Sea to Children of the Soil or something like that. I chose this Children of the Soil to kind of emphasize these spatial transformations that this group, as well as many other migrants across the city, took on and carried out. And I chose Children of the Soil also because it's this term Zanatan becomes very linked to contestations over citizenship that emerge with the rise of nationalism that I get into kind of towards the end of the book.
Yeah, of course, it's a fascinating transition that you describe in some of the middle chapters, and I really enjoyed reading it. You finished that answer by referring to the more recent past and nationalism. The epilogue to your book is entitled Unfinished Histories. Thus, I wondered, what's at Mojanga now? From my location here at McGill University, I rarely hear about Madagascar from the global media, except for negative reasons, often related to either political instability or humanitarian needs. And of course, this reflects the priorities of global media as much as, or probably more than, conditions in Madagascar itself. For our audience, could you just reflect or tell us more about Majanga now in the 21st century? And how is the history you describe in Children of the Soil playing out in the present?
Yeah, thank you for that. So I think to answer this, I need to just briefly explain that the book ends with a very violent event that happens in 1976-77. 1960, Madagascar gains its independence. And there's a kind of period of neocolonial rule where things more or less stay the same. The ties economically and diplomatically to France are retained. But by the kind of early to mid 1970s, people become increasingly frustrated with this. And so what we see are large scale political mobilizations and the rise of a kind of socialist revolution. So with that comes kind of new ways of thinking about national identity and citizenship. And in that context, the city of Majunga is also experiencing increased migration from people coming elsewhere from the island, mostly maybe from the southeast and southern regions, also from the highlands. And these are migrants who are seeking work in a time of economic austerity and duress. And they enter the city and discover this kind of economic and spatial dominance of Comorian Malagasy families. And become very frustrated with their marginality in the city. And so a household dispute explodes in 1976, at the end of 1976 in December, between some of these newer migrants and Camorra Malagasy families. And that dispute then leads to a full-on kind of what some have termed an ethnic cleansing, others have termed, an expulsion. One of the local terms that's used to describe this event is the rutica, which is could be translated to mean like a tumult. And so with that, some 15,000 Comorians and Camorra Malagasy individuals are expelled from the city. Many are repatriated back to Comoros. For some of them, that's the first time they've ever been to the Comoros. It's not a place where they speak the language or feel at home. And then there's really tragically about 1,000 to 1,500 Comorians and Camorra Malagasy individuals that were killed, brutally killed. So this violent, violent event really shows the kind of fragility of these ties of belonging that people had long claimed to the city. What's interesting is, so slowly after this event, slowly some of these Camorra Malagasy families begin returning to the city. They come back from Comoros. Some efforts to reclaim their houses and their properties were successful, in other cases not. Diplomatic relationships between Madagascar and Comoros begin to kind of return to normal over time. But the tenor had really changed in the city. So where it was once very fashionable to have these, cosmopolitan backgrounds of being, have this mixed descent, and where Camorra Malagasy families had once enjoyed these kind of relatively privileged positions, there was now a heightened anxiety about who really belonged in the city. And these discourses of Malagasy national identity begin to kind of gain more traction. Also, you have continuing urban growth throughout the 80s and 90s, with more and more migrants coming to the city from across the island, again, in search of wage labor and land. By the time I was there doing most of the research in the early 2000s, many of these Camorra Malagasy families are at pains to really put this rutica behind them altogether. So there is no monument or memorial that commemorates those events. There are very limited attempts by some Comorians and Camorra Malagasy to memorialize that event, but essentially there's sort of an eroding memory around these violent events. And that's true even while older residents really recalled the expulsion and described the kind of presence of spirits that continued to haunt the spaces of the city based on that moment. Younger generations, I think, were less aware of this really difficult history. The exception to this are Comorian students, of which there are many across the island, especially in Majunga, and they were keenly aware of this very violent history. So I would say there continue to be tensions around the presence of some groups who are perceived to be relative outsiders. And that's true also for South Asians or Karana Indian families. But what's interesting in the note of this particular aftermath of the rutica is that there's now a rise of memoirs and documentary films by those in the Comorian diaspora. So for instance, there's a really wonderful Franco-Comorian film director, Hachimia Ahamada, who is part of this younger generation interested in excavating the story. So she just directed a film that's actually called Zanatan, which evokes the memory of Comorians about these events. And I think it's part of a larger push to make visible these stories, which were invisible. And I would say more broadly, across the island, there continue to be large disputes about authentic nationality and belonging, because even most recently, the president came under fire for holding dual nationality of French and Malagasy nationality. And so this continued to reveal a set of vexed debates around these issues.
Thank you very much for that. I'm going to conclude with one final question, which is the question that is common to most of the recent podcasts. What are you working on now? What can we expect to see or read from you in the near to medium term?
Yeah, so I'm changing tack in some ways altogether, but in other ways not. So I really felt that this piece of More Than Human Histories, both ecological dimensions of these histories and ancestral presences, felt kind of unfinished in the first book and something that I wanted to pursue more of. So I'm currently developing a kind of longed array environmental history that would really account for this more than human world of the island and the surrounding Mascarene Islands through the lens of human insect encounters and relationships. So I'm beginning this with a lot of work on bees and beekeeping and Malagasy apiculture, which has me completely in the weeds in all these fascinating ways, because I discovered that Madagascar was actually an important source of beeswax to Europe in the late 19th century, at the same time that honey continued to accrue incredible symbolic and ritual value across the island. So it's an emerging project that I'm still developing, but very excited about. And hopefully will put me in more conversation with you, Philip, around your interests as well in environmental history.
Let's talk off air and then we'll maybe discuss that more. That sounds absolutely fantastic. I really look forward to reading and hearing more about that in the future. Thank you so much for your time today, for your research, your excellent book. Repeat its title now, Children of the Soil. It's a really fantastic achievement, and I really enjoyed reading it and interrogating the pictures too. I also want to thank Sam Glee-Reeman for organizing and producing this podcast, and I want to thank you, the listener, for streaming or downloading. And once again, my name is Philip Gooding, and this is the Indian Ocean World Podcast.
We would like to acknowledge the generous support of the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada. The Indian Ocean World podcast is produced under the Shirk-funded partnership Appraising Risk, Past and Present. The podcast runs in conjunction with the annual speaker series at the Indian Ocean World Centre at McGill University, Montreal.